Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from April 8, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Kakayanagata Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the middle way of the Eightfold Path and understanding dependent origination to develop a profound experience of emptiness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk on the Kakayanagata Sutta is the third of three talks this week on emptiness. And the purpose for this is that emptiness has is another one of those terms that is widely misapplied and nearly completely misunderstood in modern Buddhism. The Buddha used the term emptiness more as an action word, more as a verb than a noun, more as a something to do rather than a place to aspire to. Emptiness is often portrayed as, first, that everything is empty of an inherent permanent nature, which is true, but that doesn't really have much application to what the Buddha taught. It's like saying that all apples are red except when they're not. Okay, that's a true statement, but it doesn't relate to what the Buddha is teaching. And then emptiness is often portrayed as a kind of environment to aspire to, or that nothingness, meaning the same thing, that we're seeking an experience of emptiness or nothingness. And again, that's not anything that the Buddha ever taught. And that misapplication allows for this kind of teaching that in this emptiness and in this nothingness and in this void is this inherent Buddha nature that we all have, or this inherent Buddhahood that we should all aspire to. Again, it's not something that the Buddha ever taught. And that's one thing that particularly confused me for many, many years, that if there was such a thing, if I was engaged in a Buddhist practice so that eventually I can uncover or realize my own inner Buddha nature, how did that inner Buddha nature get so confused and deluded in the first place? In other words, why am I chasing something that's prone to confusion, delusion, and more suffering? It just doesn't make sense when you really look at it, even though that's one of the main goals of the later developed schools. Again, I'm not putting them down. It's just not something that made sense to me, and it's not something that the Buddha originally taught. So he taught emptiness as an action word, meaning that we should empty ourselves of specific things. And ultimately it comes down to emptying ourselves of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So, you know, you've heard me say over and over again, the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states that ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links leads to all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering. So then everything the Buddha taught was to overcome that ignorance, to empty ourselves of ignorance. And along the way, we empty ourselves of self-referential views and anything that we might be clinging ourselves to maintain an identity. The first sutta that I gave a talk on this week is called the Kula Sanata Sutta. And in that sutta, the Buddha teaches his cousin Ananda to recognize and abandon first local clinging and attachments. In other words, clinging and attaching ourselves to the things around us, to our home, to whatever we might own, to our friends, to our associates. And then he broadens that out to recognize and abandon clinging to our universe. So he first goes through these explanations of clinging to physical objects, events, views, and ideas, and then takes it to the more esoteric teachings of recognizing and abandoning clinging to concepts that are seen as higher forms of consciousness, but again, they're simply just concepts, and we attach ourselves to it. And those planes of existence were called perception or non-perception, or the plane of nothingness or not nothingness. Again, it sounds pretty confusing, but a lot of those conceptual repositories for consciousness, for our own thinking, were something that were taught in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism, and they're also concepts that relate to the modern application of emptiness. meaning that there is some value in understanding perception or non-perception or nothingness and or not nothingness. And there isn't. It's just in this sutta, the Buddha teaches Ananda directly, just look at these things like they are. They're just attachments that are formed from your ego self. Let go of them. At the end of that sutta, the Buddha basically says to Ananda, empty yourself of ignorance. The Mahasanatha Sutta that I taught on Thursday night, and all these talks and the recordings are online too. The Buddha relates emptiness or overcoming ignorance and emptying ourselves of ignorance specifically through the Eightfold Path and understanding this thing called the Five Clinging Aggregates, this vehicle that we've created to allow ourselves to wander around in ignorance. In this sutta, the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta, the Buddha relates this even more directly to the Dhamma. So let me just read it and I'll comment on it. And if there's any questions as I'm going along, please holler out. The Kakaya Yanagata Sutta is a teaching on right view and also a clear explanation of the common misunderstanding of emptiness and non-duality. It's another myth that has developed over the years that, well, I shouldn't say over the years, it was also a common belief during the Buddhist time, this non-dual view of the world where everything is one big mass of consciousness and we're all interconnected and we all interbe and we're all interdependent on everything and everyone. And there's a physical aspect of that that's true. The same elements that make up me, make up you, they make up, they're part of the moon, they're part of planets, they're part of trees, they're part of everything. But just the fact that we have common elements has no bearing on what the Buddha taught. And it's connecting those dots where they shouldn't be connected that is simply more attachment and more clinging, and clinging to wrong views. I won't get too much further into that idea of non-duality, but if you really look closely at this notion of non-duality, it takes away our own responsibility for what's occurring in our minds, and that's the point of the Dhamma, to recognize and abandon our own contributions to stress. Okay, non-duality. I gave my speech on non-duality. The common applications of emptiness and non-duality are extreme or wrong views of existence and non-existence and create a diluted doctrine of emptiness and non-duality by fixating on these views as if they are the only views possible. And that's the other thing that many of the teachings point to this idea that we should enter and abide in emptiness and understand the non-dual nature of all things, and that's it. And if you can do those things, you're an awakened human being. Of course, those concepts themselves has no bearing in reality. So it really is just, it's chasing fool's gold because there's nothing there at the end. Initially, it sounds pretty good to some people. It sounded pretty good to me. I really thought that chasing after this conceptual application of emptiness and realizing the non-dual nature of myself and all things it sounded reasonable. It sounded like something worthwhile to develop an understanding. But as I used the flimsy teachings that hoped to develop that, I realized that it was the teachings themselves that were empty of anything that could bring me any useful understanding. Am I making sense? Okay, good. When the Buddhist teachings are fully developed, it is clear that all things in the impermanent phenomenal world are discrete in a practical sense. In other words, the Buddha taught just the opposite. He taught to see the discreteness of all things, the separateness of all things. And why? Because he's teaching us to let go of attachments. What is the motivation between the driving us to see ourselves as interconnected or interdependent or interbeing? It's clinging. And it's clinging ourselves to a concept that is in itself not based in reality. But that's a goal that leads nowhere. There's an article on the website about dependent origination and non-duality that speaks to this in a little bit more detail. The insistence on a non-dual doctrine obscures reality and contradicts right view and the entire Eightfold Path. As seen in the sutta, the Buddha shows that a non-dual doctrine is an extreme wrong view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The simple teachings on dependent origination are used by the Buddha to show what is meant by the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. When the Buddha awakened, he sat in meditation for another couple of weeks deciding how can he teach this and what framework should he teach his understanding, and that's when he developed the Eightfold Path, as the middle way between extreme views that would only seek to continue to establish a self-referential ego self in all these different realms. Notice that there is nothing in the direct teachings of dependent origination that would imply a doctrine of interdependence, interconnectedness, or interbeing, as these are non-dual teachings rooted in ignorance and wrong view. The world, in the sutta here, the world is metaphor for confused and deluded views that result in unsatisfactory experiences or ongoing dukkha, suffering. The Kakayanagata Sutta. The Buddha was staying at Savatthi, at Jita's Grove, Anatham Pandika's monastery. The monk Kakayagata approached the Buddha with a question. I don't understand right view. Can you teach me how right view relates to the world? Simple and direct question. Kakayayana, the confusion and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing views, from those extreme views that we just talked about, including extreme views of what emptiness or nothingness is. There is the view of a permanent existence and a view of permanent non-existence. This is this really relates to the idea of a view of materialism, meaning that who I am right now is who I will always be, and that me continues forever and ever and ever, endlessly into the future, and it began endlessly into the past. There's a permanent fixed self. And the other extreme view was that there's no such thing as emptiness. I mean, there's no such thing as any real inherent reality. Everything is empty, hence, or non-existent. Those are both extreme views that the Buddha addressed 2,600 years ago. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that non-existence does not occur. Furthermore, when the cessation of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that existence does not occur. So again, that sounds a little confusing, but when the Buddha is saying that non-existence doesn't occur, he simply means that everything in the phenomenal world is in a constant state of becoming. That points back to impermanence. And the idea that anything is permanent can be established is also false, existence or non-existence. Everything is in a constant state of flux, of change, and that's the middle view between those extreme views. Is that clear? That's an important point. There's nothing that we can take in the physical world. We live in a world that everything is impermanent, including our views of self. Hopefully we'll recognize that. So we can never establish at any point in time a fixed and permanent self. That's another thing that's developed over the recently, but it was common back during the Buddha's day, is that there's some kind of power. There's even books written about the power of now. Well, we can become very fixated on what's occurring right now. And that's another type of tension in our minds. A relaxed and peaceful and calm mind that understands reality understands that common flow of life, of everything is always becoming. And that's a very gentle and peaceful way of looking at the world, rather than become fixated on what's going on right now. We can create too narrow a focus of the present moment too. The Buddha continues, the world is sustained by attachments, by clinging to conditioned thinking and wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The world that the Buddha is talking about now is metaphor for a confused and unsatisfactory experience. One who has developed right view no longer clings to attachments or fixated or conditioned thinking or self-obsession. Self-obsession is a constant need to continually maintain this ego personality. It is understood that stress arising is stress arising. It is understood that stress passing away is stress passing away. In other words, we're simply recognizing life as life occurs without the need for it to be any different. In this, their knowledge is independent of other views. This is how right view relates to the world. Now remember the Buddhist teaching his assembled Sangha, and even at that time, there was a lot of confused views that were being developed from other teachers and other so-called dharmas, and the Buddha is cautioning them about that here. The view that everything exists is a wrong view, and the view that nothing exists is another wrong view. My Dhamma avoids these extreme views. I teach from the middle. I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. The middle way shows that suffering originates and is dependent on ignorance. And then he goes through the through dependent origination. From ignorance of four noble truths, as a requisite condition, come fabrications. Fabrications are another word for assumptions. From fabrications, as a requisite condition, comes consciousness, and that's consciousness with a small c. It's ongoing ongoing thinking, conditioned thinking, that is rooted in that initial ignorance. From consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form, meaning identity as this permanent physical self. From name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base, or six or five physical senses, plus ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance. And this is how we come in contact with the outer world. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. From contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. From feeling, as a requisite condition, comes craving. From craving, as a requisite condition, comes clinging and maintaining. And that's what we're doing in each and every moment from self-referential views. We're maintaining that ignorance through clinging and maintaining. I think I should apologize to Jen and Linda for this is getting rather... There's no such thing as an advanced teaching in this. I don't believe there is. But in the proper context, this is a lot more easy to understand. So excuse me for that. But I'll get into this just a little bit more. But this is what the Buddha awakened to, and it basically states that from ignorance of four noble truths, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. This is a rather long-winded way of saying it. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Now, the Buddha is not necessarily talking about physical birth. He's talking about giving birth in each moment to another ignorant moment prone to suffering, unless we do something to recognize and abandon what we're doing. He continues, such is the origination of extreme views and the entire mass of confusion, delusion, and stress. Now the Buddha takes us through how to undo this. Now, from the remainderless fading and cessation away of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. And that's really the important point. From the fading away of ignorance, ignorance of what? Of four noble truths, comes the cessation of fabrications or making false assumptions about the world. And it's at that point that this whole 12-link chain of dependencies falls apart. Another way of saying that is we have now awakened, we are now fully mature human beings, because we've emptied ourselves of ignorance of four noble truths. But let me continue the sutta. The Buddha's taking us in reverse order how to undo this process. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness or conditioned thinking rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form, meaning identifying ourselves as only this physical form and this is all that I am and all that I ever will be. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. In other words, we stop creating an identity solely on what's coming through our senses. We have a much broader and more spacious view of what's actually occurring. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. And that doesn't mean we stop having the ability to experience the external world. We simply stop using the external world to verify and validate our own ignorance. It's now seen clearly that what's occurring is simply what's occurring. And this leads to the next thing. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Feeling in this sense is any disturbance in our mind. So the Buddha is not saying that when we awaken we just become this unfeeling lump of something. We simply stop reacting to what's going on in our world by wanting things to be different than they are. And so that feeling of an agitated mind subsides and we remain at peace. That's something that people get a little confused too about feeling in the right application. Feeling in this application is simply any disturbance in our mind. It's not just a physical feeling or just an emotional feeling or a combination of the two. It's any disturbance in our mind. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. And again, pointing back to giving birth to another ignorant moment. When this process is done and we've stopped living life from ignorance, we stop creating any confusion, delusion, or suffering for ourselves. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, and despair all cease. Not a bad deal, huh? such as the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of stress. So again, he's teaching us how to bring this whole process to cessation. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful, separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. So we've talked about that, but he's tying it directly to this thing that we've created, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and resulting consciousness, that we attach our views to and we cling together to say, look at this. This is an establishment of a self. And the Buddha is pointing out in this sutta and every other reference to the five clinging aggregates, is look at each one of those components, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. And every one of those components is impermanent. And if it's impermanent, if they're impermanent components that we're using to establish a permanent self, how can we do that? It can't be done. Just the attempt is rooted in confusion and deluded thinking and can only lead to suffering. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming, meaning continually establishing this thing that can't be established. I need to maintain my ego self. Above all things, I have to establish this ego self. No matter how confused and deluded those views might be, no matter what those views might drive me towards, it's all that I know, and I must defend this until the day I die. And the Buddha is saying, those views that you're using to establish yourself are rooted in ignorance. Let go of the views. And he teaches us how to do that, too, through the Eightfold Path. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and even craving for non-becoming. That's the idea of aspiring to some conceptual place of nothingness or emptiness. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading away and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. Meaning craving for the continual establishment of my own self-referential views rooted in ignorance. The reason why I say that, rooted in ignorance, is it feels like we're letting go of something that's substantial. Many people feel like this is annihilation. What's going to become of me when I let go of all self-referential views? There'll be nothing left. In fact, there's some schools of Buddhism that says when you awaken, poof, you're gone. You just disappear. Of course, the Buddha awakened. He hung around for 45 more years. He didn't jump on the poof train. He stayed here and lived a very, probably the most effective life than any human beings ever lived. It's silly how we come to these conclusions, don't we? So it's not annihilation that we're letting go of. It's not annihilation that's the result of letting go of self-referential views. We're letting go of views that are rooted in ignorance that can only continue ignorance and only continue more confusion, delusion, and suffering. In essence, we're letting go of nothing. In the Kulasanatta Sutta, the Buddha references this whole mass that we think is so important to maintain. It's like foam on the river. There's nothing there. Actually, that's the Fena Sutta that I'll be teaching Tuesday. We're like, what we think is so important, what we get in arguments over, what we spend our lives trying to protect, what leads to all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering and wars in the planet, is self-referential views and the need to defend those no matter what. It's like foam on the ocean. Let go of the views. There's nothing there. There's nothing worth defending. And what you gain is a calm and peaceful mind and lasting peace and happiness. So, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. That's the end of that sutta. The Buddha concludes that most important sutta on emptiness and how to empty ourselves of ignorant views by presenting the Eightfold Path, which is the only path he ever taught. And it's often that Eightfold Path that is either diminished in importance in modern Buddhism or dismissed entirely. It's seen as anachronistic or somehow as a initial teaching, but not terribly important. Of course, for 45 years, that's what the Buddha taught. He taught to empty ourselves of ignorance through the Eightfold Path. And we start substituting anything for that, or not developing it fully, we're not going to develop what the Buddha hoped to develop, which is a calm and peaceful mind. Again, the Buddha taught a path for human beings to be able to access and develop in their life, not in some future life. It's not meant to take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes to develop. It's meant to be developed right here in this life. Now, there's no time frame. It's not like, okay, we're going to start meditating today and 3 weeks from now we're all going to be good to go. But it is meant to be practically applied, and that there the very real possibility is here for every human being to achieve awakening as the Buddha described awakening, a calm and peaceful mind, a mind resting in equanimity. And isn't that enough? Why do we need to embellish that? Why do we got to look for something beyond that? Of course, there's nothing beyond that for human beings. What's most important to all of us? What do we all want? We all want to be happy. We all want to feel secure. We all want to have a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring. We want to try to create, in fact, most of us go through our life trying to create the scenario, the scene, the environment where we can feel comfortable in our lives. But we can't do that unless it's our minds that we heal first. Years ago, I was in a construction business, not all that far long ago, but I used to get, I was fortunate I got customers that had a whole lot of money. In fact, I remember one time I did I put the roof on Seward Johnson, who was the head of Johnson & Johnson.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
When he built that place down in Princeton, Yasna Palana. I think it's a golf course now. I can't say that what I'm going to say because I identified the person. Let me say it this way. It's not right that I would say something that would be derogatory. So this has nothing to do with Seward Johnson. It has to do, and I had a lot of very, very wealthy people. Many of them were just wonderful people. But many of them seemed very, very unhappy, even though they were living way beyond even a so-called American dream. They were so caught up in maintaining their lifestyle that it seemed like they couldn't even appreciate what they had in their life. And then I'll relate this back to another, it doesn't necessarily have to be, I'm not saying that all rich people are miserable, they're not. But it was surprising to me at a young age how unhappy many of them were. A few years ago, I got a call from a guy, you've heard me talk about this story, but it relates to this directly. I got a call from a guy in Newtown, Pennsylvania. And I could tell from his voice that he was very agitated. And he started telling me a story. I'm 38 years old. I'm living the American dream. I got a beautiful house, a beautiful wife, 3 kids, all the cars, everything anybody could ever want. And I feel like I have nothing in my life. And he says, and I've been a meditator for 20 years. And already I'm starting to get an inclination. I think I know where he's going. I said, well, tell me a little bit about your meditation practice. He said, well, for 20 years I engage in this certain practice and I focus on nothingness. And that's my meditation. I try to achieve this state of nothingness. And I said, well, you say that again. He says, for 20 years I've been using a meditation practice to focus on nothingness. And almost through the phone I could hear the light go off in his head. And he said, holy, for 20 years I've been focusing on nothingness and that's what I have in my life. That's what he was experiencing. He understood that. The point of all this, what we focus on, we're going to get in our life. And if we're focusing on, this gets into probably next week's talk on emptiness a little bit. If we focus on something that is outside of the Eightfold Path, the only path the Buddha ever taught, we can't hope to develop what he was trying to teach us, can we? It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. If you want to learn something else, that's fine. But if you want to develop a calm and peaceful mind, lasting peace and happiness in this human life, develop the Eightfold Path. It doesn't hurt that much. Anybody can do it. It does require a very specific focus, meaning being focused within the Eightfold Path, and it requires a very specific meditation method and the purpose behind that method. So the meditation method that the Buddha taught was shamatha vipassana meditation, primarily for deepening concentration. Why? So that it requires a well-concentrated mind to hold in mind the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path and to develop the path. It's the only reason the Buddha ever taught meditation. And then he taught the path to empty ourselves of all ignorant views. So that's the talk today. I'd like to hear, you have any questions specifically about the talk, and then we'll just go around the room. Everybody's good? Everybody got it? We're good to go?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's start with Laura. Laura, it's good to see you.
Great to be here.
Glad you're back.
Glad to be back. I think what I got out of the talk is just that it's a practice. It's an ongoing practice. And there's nothing can be, you can't set your mind to what it's going to be like, because it's continually in the state of practice if you're going to follow this particular path. So, it's nice to be here. I'm really glad that my mom and sister came. I've been hoping for a year at least that they would come and join. Being on vacation was really wonderful, of course, going to the warmth and the sun. But it was really interesting to... I had read the sutta about the nun, you know, and talking to her husband while I was there, and I was pondering it often and thinking about this, you know, the self-identification and the ego and I-making, and it was just really wonderful, actually, to be on vacation and to we went camping and we stayed in a hotel and kind of be moving around in these different environments and locations and seeing new things and just observing my process of self-identifications in these moments and having to kind of renunciate. And, you know, it was, I mean, traveling with three kids, there was always something that wasn't quite right, you know. There were moments of, you know, real relaxation, but, you know, so, yeah, it was really fabulous because I was just in this constant practice of you know, you have to plan to have some idea of what you want to do, and it just doesn't turn out the way you want it to go. Mm-hmm. And so I really got to practice the Eightfold Path and in the sun. It was really nice, but that sutta was really great.
Thank you. You're describing living a life from the framework and integrated with the Eightfold Path. That's exactly how it is. You see life, you notice the impermanence of things, you accept that the best laid plans are going to change, and you go with it. You know, you maintain a calm and peaceful mind. Thank you. Jen? Did I remember your name correctly?
Yes.
How was your meditation, and do you have any questions or comments about what I talked about?
I'm sure I have like 1,000 questions, but I'm going to let it all kind of soak in.
Okay.
Because there was a lot today. It was good. It's hard for me, which is why it took me so long to come here. But it was nice to sit in my thoughts and let go of them and not cling on to them. I don't have much to say because it's new and but it was really nice. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Jen. I'm glad you joined our sangha today. You were able to maintain the method. You recognize when you're caught up in your thoughts.
Caught up in my thoughts and caught up in like my body. I can't sit still for a long amount of time.
Yeah. Well, 30 minutes is a long meditation first meditation.
Sorry.
So
no, it's good.
But yeah, you did it though, right? Yeah. I mean, you showed yourself that you could sit for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest to both of you, if you're going to start a meditation practice, to start with short periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes at the most. And if you can do that twice a day, And understand that meditation is not the entire practice. There's more to learn, and that's what classes are about here. Be very gentle with yourself. Don't expect too much out of yourself. Don't judge yourself or the practice harshly. But if you want a meditation practice, there's one catch to it. You got to actually sit. But again, be gentle with yourself and don't expect too much, and hopefully you can continue to join us here. So. And Linda, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
It was good. I mean, this is new to me, and Laura's been trying to encourage me. Actually, my husband, because they recognize certain things about me, and certain things in your talk really resonated with me about stress and the impermanence of things. But that really just things are always in transition. I'm an art teacher, and I've grown with that, but that's a perfect example of, how nothing is ever the way it's going to be. It's always changing, it's evolving, and so that resonated with me, and being able to sit, I kind of knew I'd be able to do it, but I'm a little bit like my daughter. Sometimes it's hard for me to sit still, but it's just good. I feel like I need to be more at peace and still and do something more than I'm doing right now for myself to evolve.
Well, again, I'm glad you joined us today. That's how everybody is. The first noble truth is that dukkha occurs, or there is dukkha. Dukkha means everything that's disappointing, unsatisfactory, all the way up to extreme emotional and physical suffering. In a word, stress. And that's the common human problem that the Buddha identified 2,600 years ago. And then he taught a very simple way of how to stop, bring to cessation our own contributions to that stress. And that's all that this is about. But when you look at it, it's all that everybody wants, to develop a calm and peaceful mind. So you gave yourself a good start. And that insight that you have to impermanence is key to understanding all of this. So you're well on your way. I'm going to ask Laura what she had to do to get you here today.
Well, it's the first day I went to Vancouver, it's the first day of spring break. So I need most of all on weekends is to sleep late. And I thought, I can get up early on Saturday because I've gotten 7 more days to sleep.
Good. I'm glad that worked.
This has been wonderful.
Good. I'm glad you joined us today. There's a yellow booklet out there that describes this meditation method in the little bit of the broader framework, so please take that. On my website, there's a recording of this meditation method that you can download and listen to and help you guide your practice, and there's years and years of talks and articles like this that I talked about today that you can listen to. There's a page that's linked at the top of the website called for new visitors, and if you want to start there, that'll kind of direct your study to where to begin. But I'm glad you came today. Thank you, Laura, for bringing your family. Jen, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. So emptiness, this talk today, really kind of the parts that resonated for me were there's a lot mental activity that can take place when I listen to suttas and talks. Then it turns into a story that is definitely clinging and not helpful. And I think because I just kind of went through like a period of about a month and a half where I was really caught up in myself, and then kind of had an epiphany of realizing that I was, and really what needed to happen was to kind of come back in. and just attend what was happening in here, what's happening with me in a very physical, spiritual sense, rather than in a story of my day or in of I making sense.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, then I was able to, and essentially once I did that, almost immediately, all of the month and a half story just disappeared. You know, it was work stuff, and I was like getting caught up in being angry and, you know, why does my boss have to be this way kind of thing. And once I realized that I was out here and I was putting myself into this story of work and my boss, that I was stressed out. It was causing angst. And what I needed to do was empty myself from the world and kind of come back to here and just watch what was happening inside. And not try to make it, you know, not try to analyze it in terms of the Eightfold Path, which I think I can really tend to do a lot. That was very helpful. And I kind of had to really drop even, you know, identifying things as clinging or identifying things as, you know, identifying right view or wrong view or dukkha, and just kind of be like, you know, let's go to a place of where there's no words. And just kind of attend that. And now, listening to your talk, that experience does. I see how that's a middle, kind of a middle way, because it is focusing on me. So there's that piece of it that's still there's still kind of a little eye making there, but it's not a cerebral kind of eye making. It's not a thought process, and it's a it does create cessation of all of those things that you mentioned.
Yep.
All the 12 links is really, so it's almost like a way to it's a something to do to get there, and that's kind of where I think I was just really struggling, because it was always like I was trying to do something up here, thinking about how to identify or how to not cling to this or how to, you know, not, and that was still a story.
Yeah.
And it really has to be this kind of, the effect is that I stopped thinking and I stopped clinging and I stopped creating a fabrication, but the action is attending to myself in a way of where there's no words, just being and observing.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
thank you. The emptying the world of yourself really is what this is all about. To stop projecting yourself, clinging yourself to the external world as an identity. But what you're describing is recognizing a very subtle form of eye making that is almost inescapable from a conditioned clinging mind. In other words, we can't help but make another identity over our Dhamma practice. Even if our Dhamma practice is perfect and pure, it's just a natural progression. But as we continue to develop it, you start recognizing the eye making and even that.
Mm-hmm.
And the word you use, the story, you're recognizing the fiction that our own, that we've created out of our own life. There's no real reality here. It's just a story. And once we wrote the story, now we gotta keep that story going. And it's exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so stressful. Rather than understanding that our lives are always in a constant process of becoming. What's going on right now? Where is my mindfulness? Where is my concentration? Right here, right now. And the other things, we talked briefly about this morning. The ego isn't necessary to function in the world. We will naturally do the things that we need to do. We'll naturally, when it's cold, we'll put another coat on. When we're hungry, we'll eat. We don't need an ego self for doing those things. But if we have one, we're going to create an identity over that. We might say that if I eat, the only thing I'm going to eat is filet mignon, because I deserve that. Well, that's going beyond eating, isn't it? It's eating for an ego self now. Or I'm only gonna wear cashmere coats when it's cold out. You know, it's an extreme view that's rooted in an ego self, rather than understanding the process, understanding the agitation, understanding that my boss is always going to be that way, and I shouldn't want them to be any different because that's the way they are. They can't be any different. Whatever is occurring can't be any different than it is right now. That doesn't mean that it won't change. It will. But we accept life as life occurs. Why? Because that's what's occurring. There's no right or wrong. There's no approval of it. We learn the difference between acceptance and approval. Why? Because this is simply what's occurring right now.
I feel like when I can say, I can see when I'm upset about something that I have no control over, and I can see myself saying, I'm angry at my boss for being different than the way I want him. But once I'm there, getting out of that, that's the, you know, I'll see that and I'll even, you know, identify it as that's what I'm doing, but it's still somehow, you know, the thinking about it, that's not how to get out of it. It's,
yeah,
it's, you know, that just drives it.
Yep, but first
for
you have
me,
to.
It has to be something.
You first have to have the framework for seeing it,
right?
And then when you see it, again, it's an easy thing to fall into. Then you start analyzing it, even against the Eightfold Path, and what part of it is
right.
this, and what,
mm-hmm.
instead of just recognizing it and abandoning
right.
it, this is a disturbance in my mind. It doesn't matter. I mean, that's where meditation and a well concentrated mind comes in. We don't have to figure things out. We train ourselves in meditation to recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts or an external situation. What do we do about it? Come back to the breath. Let it go. Continue to create that spaciousness.
I was just going to, you know, in reference to my experience with the frustration with one of my children, that's usually where it comes from. Usually where my friend, you know, things not. So that's what I'm, you know, and I can relate to what you're saying, and I think that, like there's just times when, you know, I'm observing that I'm frustrated. This isn't, you know, this car ride is not going the way I want to go. It's been 4 hours and you haven't stopped talking. And, you know, and I've asked you, you know, 10,000 times and I'm so nice and I'm so patient. And, you know, yada, yada, yada. But again, you get to a point where you're like, obviously I'm aggravated. This isn't. And you have, like, you feel like righteous to, like, have your say and have your way and, like, So you build up yourself, and you're identifying yourself, and then you kind of go back into your renunciation or whatnot.
Yeah.
I found there in moments, not very frequent, but that sometimes I just like you just well I don't know like I don't know how to respond to this right now. Like there's kind of a. There can be this place of, like, where you're saying you're in,
mm-hmm.
of, like, not knowing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, something blossoms out of that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, some miracle or grace, like, falls upon you. The child, stop talking. you know, or whatever, you know, where I said one thing and it was just the right thing, you know, and it didn't necessarily come from
mm-hmm.
a thinking place.
Yes, yeah. Right.
I feel like you're
telling
yourself having that, like coming into yourself.
Yeah.
Have that sort of.
I don't know.
Experience.
And I'll have to know.
Yeah, you know,
yeah.
have to know. And anyway, so sorry to keep it going, but.
Mm-hmm.
No, thank you. I mean, and that comes from a well concentrated mind that has integrated the framework of the Eightfold Path. Sounds like a long way of saying you just know what to say and how to act. We know how to live in the world. And if. At times we find ourselves agitated, we don't beat ourselves up. You know, it's just that's part of being. Dukkha occurs, explains why we get upset. It's part of living in the world. There's difficult, stressful situations. That's just a consequence of living in the world. We can't escape that. What we can escape is the second hour. What we can escape is our contribution to furthering our stress by reacting to things. I mean, reacting in a way that often exacerbates whatever the problem is, even if it's just in our own mind. Wanting something to be different than it is agitation, and always will be. That doesn't mean that we have to approve of a kid that's constantly talking in the car. Mary, it's good to see you this morning. Have a great day. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Good.
How are you?
To be here. Fine, thank you. The emptiness suttas were very, very confusing for me to read when I read them before coming. But I've sort of gotten a little bit of insight by listening to what you said today. But I really think that I would like to go through another class, because I find myself not really being able to tie things back to the Eightfold Path. And after what Jen said, maybe that's good. I do something that, or I have a thought that makes me feel bad, or something happens that makes me feel bad, or somebody says something that makes me feel bad. I recognize that bad feeling as my reaction, not a response, but a reaction to that. I recognize that, and I can then stop and take a deep breath, and maybe deal with it at that moment in the right way, but a lot of the time not, until I get to a point where I say, well, I think I have to go meditate. So it seems like I'm meditating because I'm upset, which I don't think is the right way to be doing things. I don't know if that is something, you know, that I should be using meditation for. That it's more like I should be meditating. I mean, I'm trying, then when I start to do this, I say, now you're beating yourself up.
I'm being gentle with yourself.
And that's really not it. It's that I would like to get back into right view when I'm not there, because I feel calm and relaxed and happy when I am there. And I can't always get there just unless I go meditate. It's the only way I can get there. Like the meditation here today was just so nice. I really had a good meditation here, and I really felt like I was able to empty my mind. But even when I meditate at home, it's very hard to get to that point. And I've meditating for a long time is very helpful in getting me to that point. And I think when I'm home, I don't feel like I can meditate for a half an hour. I don't know why I don't feel, I mean, I probably could, but it doesn't happen. And I guess I just had a week of struggling.
How long are you meditating at home for?
Maybe 15 minutes.
So
20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's plenty. And if you feel like adding a couple of minutes, go ahead. You know?
It's that I get, I'm so distracted at home.
Well,
that it's hard for me to, you know, like even, you know, get my mind in from quit thinking about, well, I need to go do this, I need to do that, while I'm meditating at home. But when I'm here, there's no distractions.
Yeah.
So it's something I can do and do, you know, I feel very good about how I meditate here.
It is. It's just that way.
Yeah.
What's your meditation space like? Is it is it something that that's put aside just for meditation, or is it on the couch in the living room?
No, it's in the bedroom, and I shut the door.
Yeah.
And it's private, and it's very lovely.
Yeah.
You know, to be in that space.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that's all you can
yeah.
do, and. Well, getting back to something you said, that is it okay to meditate when you're just trying to feel better or calm your mind? Absolutely not. Don't ever do that. <That's good. laughs> That, I would say that shouldn't be the only motivation for meditation, but when you're agitated, that's a good time to meditate, you know, to try and get back to your center and calm your mind. There's nothing wrong with that. And then to continue just what you're doing, Becky, you're developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path as you go along, rather than thinking that it's just you just look at it once and you got it.
Right.
You're deepening your right view.
Rereading the book helps me too.
Yeah,
which I've been doing.
It's an ongoing process. I would say you've made remarkable progress in just a couple of months. Knowing the difference from a calm and peaceful mind and an agitated mind, I would say, is something you never realized 6 months ago. Excuse me. That's significant to recognize. So the increasing concentration and the increasing peace that you're able to develop within yourself. You know, so good for you. I'm glad you're here this morning. Eva, good to see you.
Internal dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens, of course, when I meditate, but then it's all the time. It's when I try to go to sleep, it's when I try to do anything, and I just never really realized how constantly talk about, you know, somebody talking all the time, it's in my head, and don't know how to stop it. But then reading The Emptiness, well, that just confused me. I got some little things about it. I think I think I got confused as one you were supposed to be discussing today. But that's again just my internal confusions. And then I'm just trying to stick with the impermanence, because that's something that I can understand and I can see and I can, you know, in the whole internal dialogue, you know, I just thought that, and the next minute I'm thinking something else, and it's entirely different. And talk about impermanence, you know, I felt this way, and now I feel this way. So it's just, I wanted some emptiness, I need some quiet inside my head, and I'm just trying to, finding that again, the impermanence, the idea of it, that I forget about it, because basically, when we talked about before, Noble Truth, you mentioned the impermanence, every talk really has to. Reference back to impermanence, mm-hmm. and yet I forget about it, and it's kind of a comforting thought to know that there is impermanence, and that, yes, you know, things are going to be different. You just have to not hold that dialogue and keep creating that story and repeating it over and over, and the whole, you know, it's just satisfying to know that there is a thing that I can do, and right now holding to that impermanence part of it is the major, a way to kind of hopefully find myself
out. Yeah.
Internal dialogue.
It is. Thank you. It's also the third noble truth speaks to that. That cessation of the process is possible. It speaks directly to impermanence. If there wasn't such a thing of impermanence, we'd be stuck in dukkha. There'd be no way out. And that dialogue that's always there, it might be a little annoying to recognize it now, but it's important to recognize it. That's what you do. And that's just a constant need for maintaining self-referential views. One thought, clinging to the next thought, to the next thought, to the next thought. But as you recognize it and deepen your concentration, it falls away. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're here. Diane, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for loving it so much. You're here every day, every week, and what you're doing. I'm hearing myself and everyone who's spoken, and the thing that I think is, I've chuckled about this all week long. My ego tells me that I should be able to figure this out. I have the intelligence, I have the methods, I have everything. You know, this is like past ego dialogue going on, like, I should be able to do this, I should be able to do this, I should be able to do this. And having had the experience a week or so ago of meditating and then doing this counting thing to just focus on the numbers. Like I said, I went to 110 and then I start over again. And if I don't remember where I was, I just pick a number and start counting from there. And I felt like, oh, there's nothing going on in my brain. Oh my God, what's the matter? I have to be thinking. I have to be figuring this out. I have to know what to do. And then another voice in my brain says, oh, these people always do this to you. They always get the better of you. You might as well just give up and, you know, go with it. And then I go back to this feeling of there's nothing in my head, and I got scared, feeling like, oh, well, what everybody said is true, that I'm nuts, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm not very smart. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe that's true, and that's okay. But how I felt when I was in this place of nothingness was, I really had this vision, kind of like when I was a kid, and I would see, you know, a spider climbing the mountains of grass, the steeples of grass, and just, you know, being there with the spider. It seemed so simple to be a kid when I was watching, you know, out just sitting in the grass kind of thing. And I really liked that. I didn't have to know anything. And everything just was. And when I having had that experience now, I mean, a week or so ago, I go there. I thought, that's okay. That's where I really want to be. And then what seems to flow from that, you know, what ego would call dumb, stupid, ignorant, you know, lack of chatter, is sweet. Is a sweetness that it's like, oh my God, is that, and it's not a mind making me, but is that coming, is that emanating from me? And I as the week has progressed and various steeples of grass have come before me, I'm more naturally going to that place of nothing again, and just letting it be. I love that Beatles song, and it goes through my head. Let it be, Mother Mary, let it be. Pardon that voodoo, but and get out of the way. And I have heard that expression my whole life. If you just get yourself out of your way, Diane, out of the way, Diane, or your way, Diane, it'd be get out of the way, get out of the way. And I never knew what it meant. And I'm beginning to experience it. And I'm, no wonder people said that to me, because I really like who I am when I'm out of my way. Much better than when I'm in there trying to intellectualize it and figure it out and be intelligent. It's kind of nice being unintelligent. So I'm very thankful that for your steadfastness and having these and teaching what you do, John. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome. Yeah, life is much more pleasant when we're not trying to defend an ego self all the time. Just being present. Glad you're here, Diane. Lorna, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. I don't really have a lot to add, but just today's talk, I'm finding every time we go through dependent origination, I'm understanding it more and more and more, and seeing step by step by step by step by step by step, and it's a fabulous piece of thinking to observe that and understand it and Buddha. I mean, it's incredible how deep people think. I have been thinking about lessening my ego personality and my views, and naturally having to have a view about things. You don't really need to. You can just accept them. I think I spoke on Tuesday on Tuesday's class that you just see something and you don't need to get a reaction to it. You can hear something, you don't need to react. And that applies to all your five physical senses, really, that you just don't need to. You can just let it be and try not to react to these things. And I'm finding a couple of times, and Nina mentioned this last week too, but it's happened again this week, that I'm finding in life more and more reinforcement of the Buddha's teaching, just in life. And it's not what people say, I'm not picking on channels of Buddha. I mean, it's just like it could be in a store, it could be just watching a film on TV. It just so reinforces the Buddha's teachings. I was watching a film on TV, I don't know if I can correctly recall it, but it said something like, enjoy your passion in life, it will be very brief. You know, whatever you're chasing after, whatever you're wanting to go to, it'll be very brief when you get there. And it will. And it's just seeing that. But as I say, that was just on. As I say, things are kind of like reinforcing the Buddha's teachings, reflecting back in life to me at the moment. I've just noticed that. I think that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a reflection of developing right view, seeing things in relation to the Dhamma, seeing things in relation to reality, is right view. Good for you for recognizing that too. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be back.
It's nice to have
you. Well, I'm coming off vacation too, and I'm having a little jet lag, and it's hard for me to meditate and stay alert today because of that. And I hadn't been able to read anything that you had posted, because I was like, coming back, I went to work, and I slept. I went to work, and I slept. And just kind of trying to make up those hours. But I think, I mean, I really related to what Laura was saying about vacation in terms of that going in with a different headset, this vacation, and about the impermanence and not having some expectations, or when things were not, like the weather wasn't great, but it was beautiful, and I was able to experience the beauty. I was in the Northwest, the beauty. beauty without the expectations, you know, by letting go of expectations about what it should be or what I wanted it to be. It just found some peace in the beauty of what it was. That so I had a lot of practice out there in terms of that. For me, it's kind of an acceptance or a surrendering to the moment. And, so that was good. That practice in my vacation made my vacation better, I think. You know, just more because of my acceptance of what was happening. Those little kind of aha moments where you let go and then it's peaceful. You know, that was
amazing really, how that works. Huh?
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, it was a blessing. So with the emptiness and the lesson, I still struggle some because I guess I have some conflicting kind of perspective or belief system, or just in terms of that, when you talked about that kind of modern Buddhism or modern spirituality in terms of that universal energy, I find that actually believing in that or that sense for me allows me to let go of myself more, actually, instead of clinging to, like, feeling like I'm just part of this bigger thing helps me have less of the I-making, have less of this is about me, you know, just that I'm not important, you know, I can just surrender to this bigger energy that's peaceful also. So there's that kind of piece of the Dhamma that I'm not sure about, you know, that I have some, you know, just not sure I agree with it or something. Anyway, comes up for me.
Yeah. And that basic theme comes up for a lot of people too, you know. That and it's really just something that we slowly integrate into the Eightfold Path, and realize the validity or the lack of validity to it, and that's up to the individual. That first sutta that I gave this week on the Kula Sanatha Sutta, the Buddha is really talking about that to Ananda in different. Maybe using different words than a universal energy, but it still kind of boils down to the same thing. There is when the Buddha awakened, and this is 2,600 years ago, he identified something that physics is just coming to grips with now, which is these, I don't even know the right word, but subatomic particles. He called them kalapas. And he said that millions of these kalapas blink into existence and out of existence, come into existence and out of existence in a blink of an eye. Millions and millions of them. We can't understand the process. He was pointing to some underlying universal energy, if you want to call it that, that obviously we're all part of. So we're not, he's not negating it, and I hope my talk isn't negating the fact that, and this goes back to interdependence and interconnectedness, there's something that does bind us all together simply by having a physical life. But we can create an identity to that that is detrimental to developing understanding, because then we stop seeing things discreetly and seeing ourselves as not completely unimportant, or overly important. In other words, the middle way is, here we are, we're having a human life. How do I best have that human life? Is it helpful to have this human life to see me as a part of one giant organism? Or is it more effective to see things as they truly are and have the point of view, have a non-self-referential point of view? And that's where emptiness comes in. So these three talks on emptiness this week, many people found them somewhat confusing, especially the first talk on Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with the repetition and the use of words that we're not used for, like non-perception and you know that type of thing, not nothingness and not nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
Those are confusing terms. But what it points to is that not creating a conceptual view of yourself in relation to the world. Stay with what's present. Stay with what's occurring in your life. That's what's most important. these other great, you heard me talk about Vajragoda, and the Vajragoda would keep coming in and out of the Buddha's life asking these great questions. And the Buddha would just say, it's your questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. You don't need to be concerned about these great mystical questions. What we need to be concerned about is how we see ourselves in relation to the world, how we see ourselves in relation to the impermanent world. What are our views like? And are those views rooted in ignorance of the way things really are? If they are, recognize them and change them. That's what's important. We learn to see the difference between acceptance and approval in all things, which means I don't have to approve of anything, but I can accept everything simply because it's what's occurring. So again, pointing back to emptiness, the Buddha used that word, remember it's translated from the Pali, and there's all different, you could use the word void, which would just accurately relate to sunatta, the Pali word, emptiness. You could use nothingness if you're careful how you apply it. But again, the Buddha is saying you need to empty yourself of self-referential views. You need to empty yourself of ignorant views. Empty yourself of ignorance. How? By developing the Eightfold Path. And that's what these all point back to. Tuesday's talk, and all these talks are recorded if you want to listen to them again, either the podcast or the video. Tuesday's talk will be on the Fena Sutta, which gets into this a little bit more directly, and I think it's probably the simplest one on emptiness, and then I'll be done with emptiness for a while. But tomorrow's retreat from 10 to about 3, the theme is on emptiness, but two very simple suttas, the Vitaka Santana Sutta and Mindfulness of Bahia, but how that relates to that. And Matt will be here leading us in Qigong too.
Those two suttas are beside those three.
Yeah, I won't be.
Total five.
Yes. Well, these don't directly speak to emptiness, but the overall theme of tomorrow is just to recognize the emptiness of ignorant views. And our residential retreat, which is just a month away now, is the underlying theme is on emptiness. We will go from the talks will be on dependent origination, then leading to the Buddha's first three discourses on the Four Noble Truths, the not self characteristic. And passions, how we create dukkha in our life. And the overall theme will be recognizing emptiness over those 4 days. So that should be a wonderful experience. I think that's it. We'll finish with the metta. With metta. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And as I said, metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and it's an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.